VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we'll be stepping into the shoes of Gareth Southgate as we pick our England 11s for the Euros, and we'll reflect on the 2-2 draw against Belgium. We'll also discuss heartbreak for Wales, another stinker for Scotland, and look at the weekend's biggest matches. And as if that wasn't enough, we'll also find out about the Englishman managing Afghanistan and the coach in League One who apparently has the toughest job in football. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have the chief correspondent of The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, the football correspondent of The Sunday Times, Jonathan Northcroft, and a former footballer who often made life tough for his managers, just like in March 2015 when he gave away a penalty in the 84th minute against Chester, which meant his Grimsby side drew 2-2, having been 2-0 up, an outcome his manager Paul Hurst described as disappointing. Gregor Robertson, don't go letting us down now.
You are delving deep, aren't you?
We're in the dregs now.
Unfortunately, I remember it.
Do you? You 2-0 up, should have won.
It was one of the really... The ball got... I think it was a corner and somebody headed up in the air, but like to the outer reaches of the penalty box. And I'm running to get it. And the guy really, really cannily just kind of ran into my pathway, hit the deck. I've collapsed on top of him. Stonewall penalty, boom. And he was a former player of ours as well, an old teammate. Nightmare. Saw him in the bar after, taking the piss. Good day, good times.
Great. We might be delving deep, but we wouldn't find out about those wonderful insights to life in the lower leagues. But anyway, from the lower leagues and to Wembley now, and a late Jude Bellingham equaliser, which ensured we don't have to panic about England losing two games on the trot less than 3 months before Euro 2024 begins. Now, gentlemen, I'd like to take you all back to last Thursday. And the question I posed, where I suggested that Kobbie Mainoo might be straight in the England team for the Euros. Whoa, said Martin Samuel. Calm down. I need to see him play first. Well, 90 minutes later, it's all right, we're not falling out, don't worry. 90
we are
minutes
falling
later.
Out, mate. I called it in here on last Thursday. I said Kobbie Mainoo should play.
You said, whoa.
You want to see him play?
I need to see him play. Exactly. And 90 minutes later, on the Times website, Kobbie Mainoo is England's future and
Tom
he needs to start
to
games
play.
Now.
Tom didn't need to see him play. He's psychic. It's the... makes you wonder why he needs to be employed, really. Because if I was psychic, I wouldn't be doing this podcast. I'll tell you that.
I won't be
and
employed.
I've seen this podcast
you
coming.
You said you enjoy it.
He loves it. He has a great time. But anyway, Martin, we were impressed by Kobbie Mainoo, weren't we?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah? Think he should start for the Euros?
Yeah. I said it in here. I actually said it in here. I mean, it is.
I knew I should have asked the producer Neil to get the bloody tape.
Yeah,
you said it in here.
You've got to see him play. Of course you've got to see him play. I called it after Brazil, 15 minutes. He's got to play against Belgium. He played against Belgium. Arguably the best player on the field for England. I thought he had a fabulous game.
What do you like about him? Gareth Southgate talked about his ability in midfield to carry the ball forward.
Yeah, I like that. I like his ability to operate in very, very tight spaces. I like the fact that he's 18 and there doesn't seem to be any great fear about him. I like the fact that he got into Manchester United's team and they couldn't get him out of it. Every team that he's been in, and Manchester United's pretty much it, but this England team, it might be the same. Once he plays once, they can't get him out because he came in against Everton for United and played so well they couldn't get him out of the team. And I think he's only played 23 matches. So, look, there will be mistakes. There will be, if you're being hypercritical, I think he misses the tackle that is the start of the move for Belgium's second goal. But it's just outside the Belgian penalty area. So there's a lot of time that we've got a lot of time to deal with it.
Lewis Dunk probably missed a slightly bigger
tackle. Well, exactly. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, but there will be mistakes and everything. But I liked him. Yeah. I like him. And, you know, you've got to see people play. You really have. But the thing with international football is you don't have too many chances. So when you say, I've got to see him play, or you want to see him play, you're only going to see him play one or two matches. And that will that makes, you know, no one gets 10 games. It's not like club football. You don't keep getting put back in and put back in and, oh, we need to have another look at him, we'll have another look at him. You don't. You get one or two chances and you've got to take those opportunities. So Ollie Watkins comes in against Brazil. He gets a chance. It doesn't go great for him. Ivan Toney gets his chance against Belgium, has a good game, has a better game than Ollie Watkins did. And now, if you look at most people when they're compiling their teams, they've got Ivan Toney as Harry Kane's understudy on the back of one match. But that's the way international football works.
Would you have him ahead of Watkins?
I would have Ivan Toney as Harry Kane's understudy, yes.
Yep.
And I wouldn't have said that this day last week because you had to see them play.
Yeah.
Mainoo, I've been a fan of since he came into the Manchester United team. And I thought we had to play against Belgium. And he started. Whether he would have started if Jordan had been fit or not, I don't know. But he started him and he took it. The kid took it. You can't argue that. You know, they played him. He did everything that you would have wanted him to do.
Yeah. Johnny, reflections on the two games and some of Martin's points there about Toney, Watkins and Mainoo?
Yeah, look, Martin's articulated very well a lot of things, I think, as well, which is probably disappointing for the podcast.
disagree with moving on.
No, but to get into the meat of some of it, I mean, he's right about Mainoo. I think he's... I can see why Ten Hag, who was gutted when he got injured in the summer, you know, last summer on tour, he saw Mainoo as, he's going to be a starting player for me, you know, and he hadn't played, but he knew what he had. And I can see why Ten Hag loves him so much, because for me there's touches of Frenkie de Jong about him, really sort of pressure resistant player, which is very important in the modern game, and very good at progressing the ball when he's got it at his feet, as Martin says, brilliant at turning in tight spaces, and he can move with it, and he can give it, you know, a player that will move you from, transition you from middle to front and all that kind of stuff. And he just looked so, he just looked so comfortable. The difference between him and Conor Gallagher was, I mean, it was really stark for me at Wembley on Saturday against the Brazilians. One of them looked like the greatest lad in the world for effort, but just simply not up to the technical level of what was going on around him. And the other just looked to the man of bore, and he really did. I do think there's a big but with Mainoo, which is that he's yet another example of an English midfielder, which is someone that tends to be better going forward than tactically, defensively, disciplined, and actually in terms of controlling the ball with passing. That's not what he does. If you look at the number of touches and passes he'll have in a game, it's not high. He's a moments player and he's a positive player, but he won't hold the midfield like a Rodri will, and that's a player that Declan Rice we thought was going to be that player, but actually he's blossomed into this everything player at Arsenal, and I think you've got to let Declan use his athletic power and get up the pitch, and he can put a pass through. But it still leaves England without control in the middle of the pitch. And I think it's so close to the Euros that player, and Gareth does talk about it, doesn't exist. So you have to play in a slightly different way yet again. But when I'm looking at England, the two games did leave me worried in the sense that there are other teams that will have more experience and more control in the middle of the park and will be more secure in the centre of defence, and that is an issue for England going forward. And Henry wrote in this sort of dissection of the squads today that England have, you know, only France are better in central midfield. I don't think that's true at all. You look at, I mean, Germany, I think you might take Toni Kroos and Gundogan and Andrich, who's doing very, very well, and Kimmich can move in there. You know,
Spain are pretty good in that area. France are good in that area. Portugal are good in that area. Italy are good in that area. So that's been the area that England have come up short with at tournament after tournament. And I'm still wondering if it's going to be the Achilles heel. But I've given you a very long answer that Maynou still gets in because it's not a perfect world for England in there. That's the point I'm making. And he's got a lot of room for growth and he already looks like he can play there.
It was a long answer, but it was packed with lots of detail. Some of the things you talked about as well suggested it worries with people who maybe didn't perform. Mm. Were there any others in the kind of two games who you thought that maybe kind of performed themselves out of a place in the squad?
Yeah, I mean, well, Lewis Dunk's an obvious one. I, like Martin, went in thinking Ollie Watkins is probably slightly ahead of Tony to understudy Kane and came out of it thinking it has to be Tony, although I still think there might be a place for Watkins.
You think you could take both?
I think you could take, yeah. I mean, there's an assumption you can only take two strikers. I think that's one of the... Why are we assuming that? You know, there are choices to be made.
Because if the argument is that Harry Kane gets injured, then that means that in the game in which Harry Kane is injured, you haven't got a striker on the bench.
Exactly.
I think you've got to take three.
Well, Tony Cascarino on Monday's show was kind of making a rather bold point, wasn't he, Gregor, about playing two strikers?
Yeah.
But his point of view as a former striker was that all three of them are great strikers who are in form, and particularly Watkins. So you take him on the basis that he had a great season.
I suppose you can argue Marcus Rashford can play in the middle, so that gives you your sort of third striker, but... We all know he doesn't shine at number nine play, really. He can play in the middle, but it's not. Yeah, he's lacking in certain bits. So, yeah, I know. And there might be a part of a game where you need two strikers on the pitch for sure.
Well, you've teed it up. Let's do it. Let's get into it. The starting 11. No injuries, assuming no injuries. Everyone's fit. Everything's gone well over the next couple of weeks and months. Starting 11s for England. I'm going to let Gregor go first. God.
Kyle Walker, Pickford in goals.
Pickford.
Although maybe your membership of the Jordan Pickford fan club's...
No, I've renewed for another year. I was only thinking the other day about this penalty save from Jorginho and great moments in some of his shootouts that get completely forgotten.
Some of his facials after that mistake were just like worthless. He was talking to himself. And then he saw him like trying to sort of arrow the right trajectory of the pass with his hand and stuff. Yeah. He was like in this mad and internal dialogue.
That's what friendlies are for. Get it out of your system.
Anyway, he's your goalie because there's not much behind him. Kyle Walker, Stones, Harry Maguire.
Yeah.
Luke Shaw. I mean, it's...
Shaw over Chilwell, left back to Union.
He is, yeah. He is.
Why?
I think he's been brilliant in tournaments for England. That's the first thing to say. I like Chilwell. I think he's having a difficult time because he's had so many recurring injuries and he's struggled to get a peak fitness and peak match sharpness and stuff. I really like him as a player. I think he had a difficult time against Brazil, but I don't think it's a massive drop-off, so I wouldn't be concerned about having him as long as he's fit.
Mm.
Your big concern is you've got two players there who are not fit very often. So,
for the sake of the game, anyway, they're both fit. We're going, they've both had a good couple of months.
Rice, I think it probably is Maynou.
Yeah?
I think it probably is. I have to say, like, you know, you've listened to what the guys were saying there, and I've said it to Martin earlier. There was a moment where the camera panned to him in this game, and you think about when you're sitting watching a game in a major tournament and how, like, weighty and every single moment feels so heavily pressurised, and just visualising him in that moment in the summer, I thought, my God, that would be like a huge ask.
Mm.
Like, considering how many games he's played for a 18-year-old kid.
In that position and
I'm not doubting that he could handle it, but my God, the pressure is just like, it's unlike anything else.
Yeah.
Like, even for a player who's coming into this at 23, 24, 25. So we do have to be mindful of that. But for all those reasons the guys articulate, I don't need to repeat them. There was a moment when he turned in the start of the second half, just turned away from a player and accelerated away and they had to hack him down. You just think those little moments are like, you can take the ball anywhere under pressure and he can make some space, he can do something, he can turn a sticky looking situation into an attack, and you know that's priceless, so I'd play him. And I think it's basically the front four from the Brazil game minus with Harry Kane up top. So sorry, no, Saka.
I was gonna
say, Saka fit Bellingham. I also think Foden. We've not said Foden. Foden demonstrated, and we saw a little bit more. Mm. Like, I wrote a whole piece about this after the Brazil game, that Gordon sort of underlined that it's good to put a square peg in a square hole. And Foden feels like he's been accommodated on the left because everyone wants to play Saka on the right and everyone wants to play Bellingham as a number 10. But we saw, particularly in the second half in this game, and Southgate referenced it, that Bellingham just started to drift a little bit more, and it left some space for Foden to come inside. And until Bellingham in the real late stages, he was probably England's most influential player in the second half. So I think they can probably work around that, those three behind Harry Kane. So that was a very long-winded 11, but I think that's the best 11.
Martin, any changes to that?
No, in a strange way, it's actually quite a dull discussion, the England starting lineup, because I don't know too many people that wouldn't pick that 11. The only thing you might argue is, there's a Joe Gomez, Harry Maguire debate, but probably not really. The case isn't so compelling for Joe Gomez that you would make that change. The front four, Minor and Rice. I think Johnny is about to challenge this, but that would be. I would have the same starting 11. And that thing that Minor does, where he gets you out of that tight hole, it's very much 1995 when England played Brazil, and when Venables was talking to the players about that game, about the challenge of that game, and one of the things that I think he said to them was, do not think just because you're marking somebody, you've dealt with the situation. Every single player in their midfield will take the ball, no matter how many people are around them. So you can have you can put two people on Kaká, you can have three people around Kaká, and Kaká will still demand the ball and they will still give it to him. So don't think that just because you're marking, you've got it covered. You've got to be absolutely prepared for your man to get the ball and for him to think, I will get myself out of trouble with this. And that's the sort of thing that Minor gives you. If you've got a player that you can pass to, and it doesn't matter whether he's marked, because he can do something with it in an incredibly tight space, makes a huge difference in midfield. Makalele could do it.
Mm. And he also doesn't take the easy option. I mean, what Declan Rice would have done in the moment where Minor broke through the lines to lay the ball off to Bellingham before they got the penalty, Declan Rice passes that ball square.
Yeah,
and that's not criticism, it's just a fact. Like, that's what most players do. They take the safest option. He saw that and he assessed, he saw there's a space and he went forward and that created a goal.
Johnny, any Jordan, changes to that?
And Jordan Henderson.
Well, I think we know
that.
the
one I'm thinking about is Harry Maguire, actually.
Yeah, and the one, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, if it was tomorrow, maybe it would be Harry. I'm not sure, but there's a real question mark in my mind about that. He hasn't played enough football over the last 2-3 years. He didn't convince at all on Saturday, and I'm thinking that when you play Harry Maguire, you can't push up the pitch. He doesn't have the pace. You have to sit deep, and because of what I said in midfield, that England are going to have to go in without the ability to control that area of the park. I think they might want to compact that middle of that area of the park instead, push up on the halfway line. They've got so many positive players that they want to play in the opposition half anyway. They can press, and pressing, obviously, you want to play higher up the pitch.
Get the point, Johnny. Who are you picking?
Guehi. Sorry. Yabba, 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 Guehi. Levi Colwill at the start of the season, I thought that's a guy that will come in and do the job, but he's been a kind of casualty of Chelsea's season, really. He hasn't played in the middle enough, played at left back.
Conta's certainly interesting, impressed, I think, option in this break.
Yeah. So you go Mark Guehi of Crystal
Because he'll play on the left, and you can put, he's got recovery pace, and in his last couple of performances for England, it looks like he's grown into an England player. So right now, possibly Maguire, just because you need Guehi back fit, blah blah blah, but I think that should be the ambition, to get Guehi in the starting lineup.
Can I present one pondering to that front four, which is just an idea, that a fit and firing Marcus Rashford might mean that you could play Phil Foden on the right and have Bukayo Saka on the bench. As wonderful as Bukayo Saka is, but because of Rashford's ability to run in behind, and if we've got Harry Kane dropping deep, Jude Bellingham in there as well, Phil Foden drifting inside.
I'm not even sure Marcus Rashford goes.
No, but absolutely. But I'm saying in a world in which he's fit, firing, scoring goals for the next couple of months, could you see that as a point, as a differential in that front four? Feel free to say no, Tom. You're an idiot.
He was a good impact sub in Qatar.
He was. And like when the game was open up, that's like an advantage having someone that a bit more direct and with that pace. So it's not. Again, it comes back to the thing about it being a moment in time when you get towards the end of the season, and we're seeing what kind of shape he's in. Seeing how Harry Maguire look. We've been on a roller coaster with Harry Maguire this season. Even this podcast has.
always believed in you, Harry.
So you know, there's a lot of football to be played between now and the end of the season.
But Martin, you think there's a world in which Rashford doesn't go?
Yeah, I do think there's a world absolutely. In which Rashford doesn't go, because
which of the kind of young rock stars?
Look, without sitting down and absolutely plotting it all, but I think there's a very strong case for James Maddison. As fractious as his relationship with Gareth Southgate has been in the past, and they would both deny that it's a fractious relationship, but without a doubt there has been a mark against James Maddison over certain things that have happened. And I thought Jarrod Bowen showed that he's a potential candidate as well. And that's not, you know, that's not a West Ham connection or anything like that, because I thought until this game, until seeing him against Belgium, I thought Bowen fitted into the category of those guys that is a fabulous club player, absolutely magnificent club player, just too short, just short of international quality. I'm not sure. I looked at him against Belgium and he fitted right in. And I think maybe this season that he's had with West Ham, and towards the end of last season as well, and certainly when he's played up front, it seems to have brought something out of him. And I was very, very impressed with him against Belgium. And as I say, it doesn't need much more than one really good game, or you know, at most two really good games. The window of success in international football is so small.
Yeah.
Jermaine Jennis had one good starting game for England, and Sven picked him for about 4 years on the back of it. He played against away in Azerbaijan in place of David Beckham, and it was blowing a gale, and we were up against it, and they thought the match might be called off. I've never seen the FA work so hard to get a match on in my entire life, because we looked as if we were either going to have to stay in Baku another night, and so everyone was going to get back on about 8 o'clock on Friday night for league fixtures on the Saturday, and everyone was going to go nuts, or we was going to have to go back there in the middle of June and play it again. And Adrian Beventon worked like stink to make sure this match was on, even though like this corrugated iron roof looked like it was going to fall in on everybody throughout the match. And we won 1-0, and Jenner's played very well in Beckham's position, and Sven picked him.
Got in.
I don't think Sven ever left him out after that, you know, because that's all you need. Because in the mind of an international manager, it's, well, we put Jermaine in there and he didn't let us down, so we've got that banker in a tournament. We can sling him in and he'll play the role and he'll do what we tell him to do, and that's all you need.
Final one to you, Johnny. Trent, like, Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, but again, this is best laid plans at the start of the season. Especially after Trent's, you know, Malta and so on, you'd have thought, yeah, he can grow into that central midfielder that I've been talking about, control, blah blah blah. But he just hasn't played enough. He hasn't played enough, and I think he's definitely in the squad. But at this point in time, I'd be going for Maynard. The one name I wanted to bring up, and I like Bowen, I think he might be on the plane for me as well, is Eze. No, not a lot of people are talking about him, but as Martin says.
You're a secret Crystal Palace fan, Johnny.
That's do you like Palace? Yeah, I do like Palace.
Eze, tell us why.
As Martin said, international football rests on such small portions of time and what players can do in those moments. And I'm looking at this riches that Gareth's got in terms of the forward options around, you know, the wide players and number 10s and so on. And just thinking, they're all decent. Cole Palmer's great. You know,
I like Anthony Gordon, etc., etc. But where England fall short, or where they struggle again and again, are those really those big opponents, quarterfinals, pressures on, or finals, whatever it is, Italy, Croatia, France. And what kind of player could come on and handle that and do something? And I just think Eze's got such incredible personality as a guy that will come and want the ball, take the ball in any area and try and impact. He's got such a range of skills. He can come back into midfield. He can take a set piece. He can get into the box. He can score. I think you always need that kind of that game changer X factor player, and he's to me more likely to go and do that than Cole Palmer. Despite Cole Palmer having this amazing season, and he's more likely to do it than Anthony Gordon. So Eze's on the plane for me.
Very interesting. Greg, are you nodding at Eze?
Yeah, no, I like everything that Johnny's saying there. It's just like, are you going to bring him and Jack Grealish as impact players from the bench that are slightly maverick?
What do we think about Grealish?
Well, it would have been Grealish, but not now. Just not playing.
But there's a lot of football between now and again.
Interesting. See, not about. Go on, Martin.
Well, no, I was going to say, one of the things that those sort of guys do give you is they give you a sort of personality that the England team might lack a little bit in its own way. It's quite strange. It goes back to something that Johnny said earlier when he was talking about France and Germany and Italy and Portugal. And we play quite like a lot of those teams. And they play quite like us. So, you know, you've got a lot of teams. You can't keep harking back to 1966 as the only time we won anything.
You've only done it once.
It's very interesting. Yeah, but it's very interesting. In 66, you know, the wingless wonders, as they evolved into, they never started as a wingless wonders. Alf Ramsey played a winger in his first three matches, just played a different one each time because he didn't fancy any of them. And that then evolves into the wingless wonders. But it made us different. We had a different way of playing to other teams in that tournament. We didn't necessarily go out wide and come in. You know, we clicked balls through the middle a lot more and things like that. We worked our way through. And it's quite interesting. You look at England sometimes and you think, well, this is all well and good, but what's setting us apart? Yeah. And at the moment, it's individual players that are setting us apart. Rather than the way we play or anything that we do, it's the fact that we've got Jude Bellingham and they haven't. Or we've got Harry Kane and they haven't. Because the way that we play is very much the way a good elite team plays these days. You know, and it's quite interesting. It's like when you see Liverpool and you think, actually, Liverpool look different to everyone. Mm. You know, Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp playing just a slightly different way. They've got their own personality and it is not the same as Man City light. Basically, which is what a lot of the teams are.
Very, very interesting. Not a bad debate, given that we all picked basically the starting 11.
We managed to, we dug ourselves out of the giant hole that you steered us towards.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Martin. Bailing me out the shit, as always. Thank you very much. Now, we're moving on quickly to just look at Wales. Heartbreak for Dan James Gregor, as his missed penalty in the shootout meant that Poland progressed to the Euros instead. This game was one that always felt like it was going to penalties, and yet in a strange way, when we got there, it felt like there was only going to be one winner.
Yeah, kind of a game freighted with a lot of pressure, obviously. And kind of all the... No one really wanted to make a mistake. Every opportunity was like a ball thrown in the box. You know, there wasn't much craft on either side. There was a lot of headers, a lot of balls up to Kiefer Moore. And look, they did have some chances. Obviously, Ben Davies came so close to scoring what they thought was going to be the opening goal, fractionally offside. But you just, I don't know, I come away from this reflecting and thinking, is Wales getting to a kind of playoff winner takes all game against Poland, can they expect them a lot more than that? They were in a group, you know, a strange group overall, in that they had positive results against Croatia and then games against Armenia and Turkey is what cost them. And then it was really, really fine margins in this game. So, you know, there's a lot of question marks about Rob Page's future now, but it seems that everyone involved in the setup wants him to be wants him to continue.
And it's, it feels like a, you know, another team being built, isn't it, around some of these players like Brennan Johnson and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I've said that the other week. It's kind of, there's a lot of young players who've grown together in the squad, and are getting to an age where they're sort of hitting their peak. So I think Wales have a decent stock now. But I still think, having said all that, this is really, and it's similar to Scotland. It's like, if they're reaching major tournaments or coming very, very close, that's where they are.
Well, similar to Scotland. Johnny, on the Monday show, Gregor came out with some deluded nonsense about how losing 4-0 to Holland was quite a good...
Listen, it was Ronald Koeman's words, not mine.
It's quite a good result. What, you got any claptrap for us about losing 1-0 to Northern Ireland?
Yeah. Steve Clarke has executed the master plan brilliantly.
Lower those expectations.
Get those expectations on the floor, because if we go to a tournament with even a shred of optimism, it blows up in our face. Yeah. So he knows
that. We've seen that in the past.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go there really miserable and see what, be dour and see what happens.
Happy? You're all right with
no,
that?
No, I'm not happy. I'm a bit worried, I have to say. I think Northern Ireland was a hospital pass of a game, because the thing that Scotland can't do is have too much of the ball and play against opponents where they're saying go and control the game, and can't do that. And you know, Conor Bradley's on such a rich vein of form, he made the difference with an amazing goal. And Scotland didn't have Callum McGregor, and he's such an important player. They'll be better with Hickey back. You know, Patterson's having a difficult season at Everton. I could see Euron Martin's reaction there, Tom.
No, I'm just thinking of now. I'm just
the tartan straws that I'm clutching at here. I know.
Mate, I'm just thinking of an Ally McLeod story from 1978. Ally McLeod.
Is that when he was asked what are you going to do after the World Cup?
No, it was with the dog when it had all gone wrong and. All the lads are gathered at the top, at the Scotland training camp, and it's all gone completely. And there'd been this stray dog, this sort of mangy stray dog, that had been around the camp and around like the press conferences. You could see it, you know, every time you went over. I was 14, but went over to, you know, the Scotland training camp. There was a mangy dog around. And it had all gone wrong, and Ali's there, and he's all deflated. It started off, you know, they had the parade before they went to the tournament, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's his dog. Oh, and he goes, oh, well, he said, at least this little fella likes me. And he reached out to pat it, and it bit him.
Yeah. Martin mentions a parade. And, I mean, if you think about it, a parade to Glasgow or Prestwick Airport, I think it was, to take off. It's just bonkers. And Ally McLeod. Yeah. And a reporter said to Ally McLeod, so what are you going to do after the World Cup? And he said, retain it.
See? That's the kind of optimism we need.
No, that's the kind of optimism we do not need.
That's the kind of thing we need.
We've burnt once. Because we know back. What happened, yeah.
Do you know what? I think I might pay for you and Johnny to go on a like parade round Scotland. Promoting the podcast, but if you like the podcast, you can share it with your mates as
well. Can I just make one point? One little point here.
Another one.
Yeah, it was just one small point. Just following on from what Gregor said about Wales, I don't entirely agree with that. And I need to tell you, when it was 16, for Wales to nearly get there, and it's a penalty shootout, and they miss out on a penalty shootout, you go, oh, that's, you know, tiny little country, really. I mean, you know, they've got to, it's 24 teams now.
And the Nations League gives another opportunity.
And the Nations League, there's a lot of opportunities to get there. Now, by the way, if you're playing, you know, they lost Gareth Bale, and, you know, the guy they're knocking it up to more is not many people's idea of a great international football. So I can understand the limitations in Welsh football. But I think now there's 24 and there's all these different, you know, it's when, like when Jorginho was complaining about Italy not being at the World Cup, and you're thinking, well, how many chances did you want, mate? All you had to do was beat North Macedonia in the end. You know, whatever mess you made of your group, you ended up in a playoff against North Macedonia. They couldn't have made it any easier for you. So there's a lot of opportunities now, and I think for those countries, because although it is a small country, and although traditionally they haven't got to major tournaments until recently, the way that tournaments have expanded now, a lot of the Welsh players play in English football. Mm. You know, they, you know, if they're good, they play in the Premier League. They play in one of the best leagues, if not the best league in Europe. There's more opportunity for those countries now than ever.
There you go, Wales fans. Let us know which side of the fence you're on, whether you're on Team Grego or Team Martin. Get in touch with me, Tom.
It's not Wales.
No, come on. You can fall out every now and again. It's all right. Don't fall out with me, Martin.
Very peace-loving podcast.
Anyway, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk if you want to get in touch with views on Wales, or maybe you want to share your England starting 11. But for now, stick with us, because we're talking about the Afghanistan manager and the weekend's action next.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson. Now, the first half of the show was dedicated quite a lot to Kobbie Mainoo and his emergence as an England superstar. And on the Times website this week, we've had a bit of fun delving into the Times archive to look at how we have reported on the emergence of some other young stars. Now, this was a great fun job. The Times archive is a wonderful, wonderful resource, and it threw up some really brilliant stories. My favourite of all was Alan Shearer, 17-year-old Alan Shearer, given his debut for Southampton about an hour before kickoff, I think it was, or something like that, burst onto the scene in a 4-2 win against the mighty Arsenal, scores a hat-trick, three paragraphs it got in the Times the next day. Quite remarkable. Huge comparison with how we'd kind of report on those things these days. Teenager's historic goal feat was the headline. Alan Shearer, the first player in 21 years to score three goals on his full league debut, and possibly the first ever to do so on his debut in the First Division, left the Dell on Saturday clutching the match ball autographed by players who were once his heroes after helping Southampton hand out a 4-2 defeat against Arsenal. Shearer, age 17, was drafted into Southampton team 3 hours before kickoff and responded by scoring three times in 49 minutes. The last player to achieve the feat was Colin Vierhen.
Vilgen, of Ipswich Town, who did so
against Portsmouth in the second division
South
match against 1967. Full stop, end of report. That was it. Imagine that now. Imagine, Johnny, you're at a match on a Saturday.
The picture of the newspaper is funny as well. It's like just lots, just like, I don't know.
Loads and loads of stories and buried in the little bottom right-hand corner is Alan Shearer. So, chaps, Johnny and Martin, I wanted to talk to you about that idea, that changing way of which we've come to become a little bit obsessed, as we proved by talking about Kobbie Mainoo for 20 minutes in the first half of the show, but also players that you saw for the first time burst on when they're bursting onto the scene, or players that you saw at a very young age and thought, that guy's got it. Martin?
Well, which one do you want me to take first?
The second question first. Players that you saw.
To be fair, I tell you what, I haven't seen too many that stick in the memory as much as Connor Bradley this season, funnily enough. Watching him for the first time and thinking this kid's a player. That's as impressive an arrival as I can remember, really. Kobbie Mainoo, who's not much different. Paul Gascoigne. I was around Paul Gascoigne quite a lot early on. Saw him score the greatest goal I've ever seen. Certainly.
What was that?
Against Switzerland's B team in Winterthur, just outside Zurich, on a Tuesday night.
Can you do it in Winterthur on a Tuesday night?
Exactly. And, you know, when you look back at this sort of stuff, so this is pre-1990, but not every national newspaper was there. because we were getting phone calls from the national newspapers that weren't there asking us to sort of turn Charlie and file for them as well, and all turned it down because the Wires had obviously given, you know, it was he scored a goal like, they score in like right of overs, basically. Picked the ball up in his own penalty area, beat the entire team, got to their penalty area, thought about passing it square for Steve Ball to tap it in, and then decided, no, I'm not, I've done all the work, took it round the goalkeeper and scored. I've never seen a goal like it. Mm. And, you know, he was something special. He was something special.
That'll be one I'm looking up on YouTube after this show.
Yeah, you can't see it.
Can you not?
You can't find it.
No.
I mean, actually, that is, it's also one of those unique. It's one of those unique memories as well. I think I saw Depeche Mode's first gig in Basildon, and you can't find that on YouTube either.
So you could be making it up.
I could be making it up. Never seen him play. But the and look, I tell you what, because it's not on YouTube and stuff like that, there could be over the mists of time. Maybe only beat seven of the team, but in my mind, he beats the entire team. In my mind, it's the escape to victory goal.
Yeah. Johnny, just before we come to some of your recollections, I wanted to read another one from the archive, which was Bobby Charlton against Scotland in 1958. And the Times wrote, this is a section on Charlton's goal. Yet the rarest fruit of all fell to the right foot of young Charlton. It was England's third goal 20 minutes after hard time, and it will be remembered even by Scots who might wish to forget. It was surely one of the finest ever seen at Hampden. The barest opening was provided by Finney as he fluttered swiftly past Parker down the left and got to the byline. His perfect centre was pitched deep into the penalty area, and there was Charlton, always fluid, always using the whole horizon for his passes, moving in like lightning. His volley with some 12 yards hit the Scottish net even before Younger could raise his hands. What Younger himself thought of it was shown when he recovered sufficiently from his thunderbolt to run out and shake his youthful executioner by the hand.
He was offside, wasn't it?
yeah.
He was offside.
Scrambled it in.
Yeah.
I thought that was, I loved that. I thought that was a beautiful bit of writing, actually. And it probably told me that we're not as good as the people who came before us. But I think we all knew that anyway. And I did bridle at the... Even in 1958, there was English assumptions. It must be one of the best goals.
Goal scorer,
Those
hammer-footed Scots centre forwards could never score anything like this.
A single goal, you know. 149,000 people at the cup final. But
are you suggesting I read that before coming to you for your recollections on purpose, Johnny? Absolutely outrageous.
Yeah, you might have done, yeah.
But your players that you've seen come through that you thought, wow, this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this. The thing, I mean, maybe we all look for different things, but I sort of think, what is it that makes you think, wow, that young guy's special? And for me, it's, what's their toolbox? You know, what are the things they can do? Speed, ball control, you know, two-footed, all that kind of stuff. Second would be, what's their decision-making? Because you see a lot of young players, but do they have a picture of the game? You know, why have they done what they've done? What was going on in their head? You try and have a look at that. And then you look at personality. And Wayne Rooney's just the one in my career that had all of that straight out of the box. I actually just started in England in 2001-2 as, you know, that was my first job as a sort of North of England correspondent. So Liverpool, Manchester was my patch. And people were talking about Rooney on Merseyside anyway before he got in the team. Walter Smith, who I knew, wanted to put him in the team at 15, 16 and slightly regretted not having done so. David Moyes sort of loved Rooney from the start. And then, of course, he has that incredible sort of goal. It wasn't his first game. I think it might have been his second game against Arsenal.
Against that, I was there for that.
You were there. I wasn't there for that. But the week after that, for the Sunday Times, I was asked to do a Who Is This Kid story, and I went to Croxteth, I stood outside Wayne's house. You could see the Everton pennant in his bedroom window. I went to the local pub, the Western Approaches, and got sort of growled at when I said I was a journalist. I did the whole kicking a ball around on the street corner Wayne Rooney story, and I was there on his debut for Manchester United, and I've never ever seen anything like it. That game against Fenerbahce.
Yeah, I was there for that as well.
I mean,
amazing.
Talk about somebody walking into the Coliseum, and
you know, his collar's ripped.
Yeah, that was my best favourite bit. Brilliant. About it. He ripped the shirt, being like,
the shirt's too tight, so he rips the collar at the neck and he comes on and, you know, he scores a brilliant goal with his right foot. Takes a free kick off Ryan Giggs, I think, and pots it in for his hat trick. I mean, just amazing. And maybe it's how papers have changed, but I remember speaking to our old editor, Alex Butler, on the way home late on that Wednesday night, and him saying, "What? Just drop everything you're doing. We're doing 2 pages on Wayne Rooney this week, and I just want chapter and verse. Is this the greatest European debut in history? Everything you can about Wayne." And it was, you know, that was what we used to do. And I don't think any young player at that age has ever ticked all the boxes in that way.
Well, it's interesting, again, looking back at Wayne Rooney, one of the rare bits of good predictions from Times journalists over the years. Rooney was listed as 6 aces in the Premiership pack before the start of that season, alongside 5 others. Massimo Macaroni, JJ Okocha, Hugo Viana, who played at Newcastle, Ali Benabia of Manchester City, and Carlton Cole of Chelsea. Slightly different career trajectory after that. Now, Gregor Robertson, you're going to do something quite outlandish right now, aren't you? And you're going to claim to be the person, the journalist, who first spotted Jude Bellingham.
No, first of all, I have to just any opportunity to say that, like, 3 months before he scored that goal, I played against Rooney in the FA Youth Cup.
Really?
And it was the closest I've been to, like, scared on the pitch. Because he was that, like, intimidatingly good.
How old would he have been then? 15, 16?
He was 16, but we were 18.
Right.
And he was, like, as physically developed as anyone. He scored an overhead kick. He was shooting from 30 yards, and the crossbar was shuddering. Like, I'm not joking. It was like... And I always say the thing that...
So surely you got his shirt afterwards, right? Because you were like, this guy's going to maybe do a little bit better.
Well, no, our manager said, John Pemberton, who was our youth team manager, we had a player who was a really, really highly thought of called Craig Westcar. And he became Forrest's youngest ever player at 16 as well. And he was in England teams and stuff and played with Rooney. And I remember he said after it, he said, he's the next Alan Shearer. Because he won the game for them. He said, he's the next Alan Shearer. And he turned to Craig Westcar and said, do you think you're as good as him? And like, but there was grounds to ask that question, and it just shows that even then there's, like, you know, Westy had a good career in the lower leagues, like, you know, not far different to mine, but Wayne Rooney was just completely different to anything you'd ever seen in your life before. I always say the most incredible one was a corner. We had a corner, and I was back, and I was kind of marking him, and the keeper caught it and kicked it long, and we were both running, like, so I was running kind of side by side with him. And he trapped it with the outside of his foot and cut away from me first time.
And you're still running in the opposite direction.
I'm still running to the other side of the pitch. Yeah, he was off this way. I think he hit the crossbar that time as well. It was like, anyway, I'll take any opportunity to see how to tell that story, because it did live with you. It was, and we all, and everyone who played on that pitch that night remembers it. And he was well known for so long.
Yeah,
we knew beforehand that this kid was good. And we knew afterwards when our manager said that. Then a few months later, you saw him score that goal.
And another kid who was pretty good, though, when it comes to your journalistic career.
Everyone knew about Jude Bellingham, too. But I just brought up the piece. First time I've written about 5 pieces about Bellingham, even when he was at Birmingham.
Yeah.
But the first one was like January 2020, so a while back. And he was 16. And the thing that I kind of mentioned in my intro was Plep Cotet, the manager, said something that just made you realise how young he was. He said, he's still young. He's grown 2.4 centimetres since the start of the season. And you're like, and there he was playing against Coventry, and I think it was an FA Cup game. You know, two championship teams going at it, flying into tackles. He didn't, I have to admit, I didn't see all the level of, like, technical skills and craft and stuff that he has now. But just being on the pitch with these guys at 16 was impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's obviously, you know, blossomed since. But again, it was the fact that he looked like he felt he deserved to be on that stage, and that's just the thing that's lived with him at every stage that he's ascended to.
Absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating deep dive into the Times archive, which you can read on the Times website now. And we're going to talk about two other features that you can read on the website. Johnny, you had a piece at the weekend, which is headlined. Bold call. I know you don't write the headlines. We can blame me and the editors for that. Headline, forget England, meet the manager with football's impossible job. Who is it and what club is he at?
Yeah, it's a good headline, Tom.
I didn't write it, but I'll pass it on.
You guys got it right. Ruben Sellers of Reading. And I also wrote in that piece that if I was voting for manager of the year, I think I might vote for him at the moment, because it's mind-boggling the situation he's found himself in. If you think that at Reading, he takes the job having been assured that all our problems are over, you know, we're financially sorted out, won't be any issues, here's our £50 million training ground, we're heading back to the Championship and you're going to build a team that's going to push towards the Premier League. And 3 days after he takes over, they get hit by a transfer embargo, which had only just been lifted, by the way. But so then he's got a transfer embargo. He starts the season with 7 players in pre-season. He has to draft about 15 in from the academy to try and make up the numbers. Pre-season's horrendous, gets hammered in pretty much every game. I think he won one game against, you know, essentially a Sunday team, 1-0 or something like that. But as these young players were trying to get to grips with his demands, because he's a very demanding coach. Mm. It's high pressing, high intensity, and quite tactically complex. And he's trying to get these kids to play it. And then, you know, starts the season okay, goes into a horrendous slump, and at the same time suffers the first of 3 points deduction, the first two of 3 points deductions. Dai Young and the fans go for the Dai Young being the Reading owner, probably everyone knows about by now. Goes to ground. The fans start invading the pitch in games, throwing tennis balls at others. He was telling me that, you know, things that you don't expect to do as a manager, having a meeting with the referee and your players beforehand to discuss what to do when the tennis balls come on the pitch and how to avoid getting sent off and don't throw them back because you'll have to get a red card. The heating went off in the training ground. Now there's a bit of dispute, you know. The official line is a boiler broke. Perhaps they were trying to save money, but the top floor of the training ground had no heating, so the staff are walking around in coats and scarves. There are 19 redundancies, so he lost his goalkeeping coach, his number two, which just meant the remaining staff having to do even more work. The catering company that was supplying the training ground then get fed up of not being paid, because it all goes back to Young not being able to basically pay the bills for whatever reason. So they pull out the training ground. Players are bringing in their own food to training and cooking their own meals and so on. And through all of this, they were bottom after 16 games with 7 points with the deductions. They're now 6 or 7 points clear of relegation, despite having further deductions.
Yeah, they're up in 18th on 42 points, six clear of relegation at the moment.
The academy kids he's brought through and developed have been so good that 4 or 5 of them have been sold already, and he's had to start again with even more. And I found him hugely impressive. He said that he'd found the key to everything was just to try and draw a line under everything that's happening around, shut it out and focus. Just, I know it sounds like the cliche, but just get the players and himself to focus on the football, because that's the release, that's why they're there, and they're on a really good run at the moment. And you know, Reading might be light at the end of the tunnel, because there's a consortium now talking about buying the club.
They certainly are on a good run. They face Northampton this weekend before playing Bolton on Monday, as long as that good run finishes next Saturday when they play Lincoln City at home. Gregor, toughest job in football for a manager, think you can top it?
I raise you with Ashley Westwood, manager of Afghanistan.
Wow.
I spoke to him this week from Saudi Arabia, where Afghanistan have to play their home games. Ashley Westwood played for Bradford City, Sheffield Wednesday, most notably. He got one promotion to the Premier League with Bradford, in fact. Started off at Man United as well in their academy, and then had very nomadic career with Northampton, Wrexham, Lincoln, your team, Tom, Portsmouth. Oh, very briefly.
Very
Portsmouth.
Briefly.
So, a nomadic career, and then he's been coaching first of all, he was assistant to Michael Appleton during the kind of wild years where he was manager of Portsmouth, Blackpool, Blackburn. So, you know, that all happened in a very short space of time. Mm. And then he's been a manager in India, where he's been a success. He won the league in his first season with a newly formed club. Anyway, that brought him to an offer in November to become manager of Afghanistan, who had just 18 players had just boycotted playing for the national team because of alleged corruption, essentially. I won't say any more than that. And his first game, they lost 8-1, I think, to Qatar. Then 4-0 to Kuwait. And then, so really, actually, the start of his job was to find a team, to kind of scour the world and find a lot of players who are refugees, playing semi-professional. Like you're saying, there's a mechanic, a barber, supply teacher, waiter, all on his team. There's some professional players. And look, obviously, the first question, as I say in the piece, is like, are you mad? Because he talked me through a visit to Kabul. He visited Kabul.
this was just like sign the contract, right? Or to,
yeah,
discuss,
to meet,
discuss the job.
Yeah, and to meet the kind of the committee and the president of the federation and stuff. And yeah, he just described a kind of fairly wild couple of days where he took a flight to Kabul, which took an unscheduled stop to kind of drop a few people off at some remote part of Afghanistan.
Like a bus?
Yeah. Like seven people got off and then it took off again, he said. And then, wow, then they landed in Kabul. And then he said a car pulls up, get in coach, take his passport. As soon as they pull out the gates of the airport, two guys with machine guns get in. That was his protection. He said, so he went to the Federation, then they said, right, we're putting you in this hotel. It's not the best hotel, but we can guarantee your safety. And he said, as that'll do for me. I don't want caviar, just don't want to be blown up. And he said it was in like a fortress. Anyway, he survived that. And the remarkable thing now is he's just played two World Cup qualifiers against India, home and away, home being in Saudi Arabia, drew the first one 0-0 and won 2-1 in India. And the nation had never before won in India. So, yeah, I'd say that's got to be up there with the toughest jobs. And also, kind of, as I said, and, he took in good spirits. Like, one of those jobs that you think, are you mad for actually taking it?
Well, clearly not that mad. He wants to test himself and he looks to be doing something all right. Well, listeners, I'll let you decide which is the toughest job in football out of those two. You can get in touch with me and decide at tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Chaps, we're going to finish with a look at the weekend's action. Before we get to the really, really big game, there's a big game at the bottom as Nottingham Forest host Crystal Palace. Now, Nottingham Forest in the news this week with their coach Stephen Reid given a two-match touchline ban and fined £5,000 for an expletive-filled outburst after Forest defeat against Liverpool. We've been doing a bit of swearing on the show lately, but I'm not going to repeat what Stephen Reid said to referee Paul Turney. Martin, just quickly on this, in terms of the insights that it gives us, this kind of written readings for the misconduct charge, what does it say about this kind of ongoing conversation we have about behaviour towards referees?
Well, that what we know is the tip of the iceberg, because the language that was used towards Paul Turney, who was useless, by the way, I mean, didn't know the rules of the game, let's be honest, but that point notwithstanding.
An understandable frustration.
Understandable frustration, but expressed in a way that just crosses the line. I mean, there is a way of making a point after the game without, and I know emotions are running high, and I know everyone can say, well, you try it, you be there, put yourself in his shoes. You can't behave like that. No. It doesn't happen in other sports. You can't go up to a rugby referee and speak to him like that, or cricket or hockey or, you know, all of these other sports. You just can't do it. And it's not in the culture to do it. You wouldn't do it. That's the strange thing. I'd sit there watching sport with one of my lads who played rugby and was playing rugby until rugby league in the second part of his rugby career, but until he was 21, and I would say it's only in the last couple of years when he's got out of the habit of, when he's shouting at the television during a rugby match, of saying sir
at the telly
literally going,
yeah,
you know, sir, come on, sir, hands in the ruck, sir, come on. And you know that, and that's, it's so ingrained into, he'd never say, he would never dream of saying that when he's watching a football match, would speak very much like as if he was the coach of Nottingham Forest. So it's a cultural thing. and unacceptable.
And Gregor, when you kind of read about this story from your playing days, that level of kind of abuse, you must have sworn at a referee from time to time.
Yeah, but usually kind of when you're running off, not standing in front of his face at the end of a game.
Yeah.
There's a difference. Like, you know, people do that and you know, it's not right and you get away with it. That's the difference. But standing there, it was almost intimidating. It was like standing, blocking him, his pass to the tunnel as well.
There was a repeated as well, wasn't there? Yeah. Repeated kind of comments as well, which makes it difficult to take.
I was at that game and it's a visual. It was horrendous seeing Tierney surrounded by Reid and other staff, the owner on the side of the pitch. If this guy having to walk off through a gauntlet, looking ridiculous, he looked so under siege and so disrespected. And you see, when you've got kids who are playing grassroots football, you realise the impact of that stuff. I've got a daughter playing under nines girls football. It's actually quite a nice environment, but some of the older age groups, you see what's happening on the on the sidelines, and that idea that the referee's just there to be sworn at,
absolutely
surrounded. It has a horrendous impact.
Mate, I could remember seeing, I think it was actually in the press box down Fletcher, and it might have been a Manchester derby. And I like Down. I've got a lot of time for Down, and he's a nice guy. But what he was saying about, you know, the sort of commentary, the frustration and commentary, and it was so totally unreasonable. Mm. It was completely biased. There was, you know, there was no... there was nothing in what he was saying about the referee and what the referee was doing and stuff that actually bore a great relation to reality. And I find that quite strange as well. The Nottingham Forest game, that is as poor a decision as you'll see. Because the guy doesn't know the rules. He restarted the game contrary to the rules. I'm not saying that's why they scored, by the way. You've got other opportunities, you know, it doesn't figure that Liverpool have to score, by the way, from that. But he didn't know the rules, forgot the rules, which is a really poor thing to do. But nonetheless, I've seen at very close quarters, we've all seen at very close quarters, football people and the way they talk about the referee, and there's no reason to it. It's so completely one-eyed, and there's a lack of sort of self-awareness about it. As if every mistake is going against them, every decision is going against them, and it's not true. It's just not true. And you shouldn't be able to speak to a referee like that, you know, regardless of the match, he said.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anthony Taylor's going to be the referee who will hopefully not be making too many controversial decisions in the Manchester City against Arsenal game this weekend. Martin, this is Arsenal's big moment, isn't it, under Mikel Arteta, kind of the last few seasons with injuries.
They've had a few.
But this feels like another step along the road.
It feels like a very big moment. They've had a few. They had a few last season. So they had the doubleheader against Manchester City at a time when if they'd have got results out of those games, two draws, and they'd have won the league. So they've had moments before. This does feel like one because they've already beaten them. And you look at the team that City might end up fielding at the weekend if John Stones doesn't recover. We think that Kyle Walker's out. Akanji, we think, could be out as well. Kevin De Bruyne looks as if he will be fit, but how fit, I don't know. I think it's more a patched up fit than a bouncing off the walls ready to rumble fit. So you'll never get a better chance. I'm not saying to beat him. I'm not saying to beat them because City will always have a wealth of talent that can win any game. But if you're Arsenal, you're thinking, well, we get a draw up there, and you know they're in the box. They could be in the box seat.
Johnny, final word from you on this big game of the weekend.
Yeah, echo a bit of that. Look, City don't lose these big games at home to their contenders, but it's a great opportunity for Arsenal to get a draw. And they're playing the best football in the country. They've been doing so since the start of the year. And they're now in top of the league. Mm. What more can you want in terms of opportunity?
Absolutely. And they're beating teams by Man City scores as well. They're putting fives and fours and fives past teams the way that City were doing the last few seasons. Sorry, Jack.
So that's it. It's, you know, you're the form team. You're top of the league. It's there for you. Mm. But they can't get beaten.
can't get beaten. Draws enough.
No, what I say, if they can't get beaten, I think if they get beaten, that, you know, this City and Liverpool take over the race.
Interesting. It'll be a big game on a big, big weekend of football up and down the country. If you're going to a game, make sure you enjoy yourself. And
leave early, because you can't get a train to Manchester for love nor money. Certainly not from London.
As your other
replacement bus service via Bedford. Good luck with that.
Earlier in the week. Yes, good luck on all your travels wherever you're going this weekend. Johnny Northcroft, Martin Samuel and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. Monday might be a bank holiday, but me and Gregor will be back with Alison and Tony Cascarina.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.